Okay, I come back. It's okay. Don't... Hello, everybody, and thank you to York to be with us. So we will discuss a little bit about this book, Power and Politics in World Athletics, a Critical History, recently published in Routledge. And I think I really enjoyed the last time when we have a discussion between Kevin Marston and I about my book and for the last webinar. So I have proposed to York to do a little bit the same. So I will chair the session and also have a discussion with York probably during 30-40 minutes, and then we can have a nice exchange, I think, between York and you. So York is also well known for the history of doping, but since some years he has also began to publish interesting papers or this book about international sports organization. And if I remember well, at the last CASH conference, you presented also something about handball, and notably this recent paper published in Sporting History with the Austin Duckworth, Annexation of Fertile Inclusion, the Origin of Handball's International Organizational Structures. So it was also an important point about the beginning of handball at international level. So, perhaps my first question to you is, as I said, you are well known about to be an historian of doping. And how do you have begun to work on EWF? What was the beginning of this interest about EWF and more generally in international sports organization?
Yeah, thanks Philippe, and thanks for having me also here. It's good to see some familiar faces again after the workshop and also the RARES conference. It's a very good question. And one that I thought a lot about when I was writing my introduction for my book. So actually, my interest in the organization that is the IAAF, or what is called now World Athletics, started when I was a volunteer at the World Athletics Championships in 2009 in Berlin. And what my task was, a funny one, that was I had to bring the press the results sheets to the president. That was a very important task. So whenever there was an event finished, I need to walk to the president's office and give him that. And the president that time was Lamine Diack. And one day I walk in this meeting room where he was, this lounge, and it happened to be that there was this man sitting there, and they were discussing the gender of Caster Semenya. Because that was the World Championships when she first appeared. And I was in this and witnessed this discussion, how this man, old man, were discussing this young girl's gender and appearance. And I found that very disturbing. And that, sort of triggered my interest. What is all behind these sports organizations? So that sort of was a starting point on... with me as a naive enthusiast for sport and sporting events, realizing, okay, that there's much more to this. So that was sort of the interest into this organization. But then obviously I did a PhD in anti-doping, and the IAAF, let's call it the IAAF today, not World Athletics. The IAAF was very important also to formulate anti-doping rules. So I came across the organization again, and I realized very quickly that there's not much literature on this organization from a historical point of view. So, yeah, I guess those two things taken together started to really interest me, and then I explored it further.
You know, First, thanks to have correct me. It's World Athletics and IWF now. It is also a point of your book. You explain this change also of name. But what I think also interesting, it's as it is more than finally 10 years that you have begun to think or about this topic. And so I think we see that in the book, because like you have taken time, you have it is also help you also your reflection to go more in depth regarding the topic. And perhaps you have said an interesting point, and it is also indicated in the introduction of the book, of course, but about World Athletics historiography. What could you say about this? What exists before your book, and what your book brings more regarding this? I think regarding the archive, we will discuss a little bit later, because of course, with more than 10 years of research, it's also helped you to have collected very enlarged materials in different countries. But perhaps about World Athletics historiography, just a brief point about
that. Yeah. So that there wasn't much, right? So you have this very standard anniversary publication, you know, 50 years of IWF, 75 years of IWF, 100 years of IWF. So you can learn this for the history. And I prepared it. It's like this kind of wonderful books, like this one, or this one about the different presidents. This kind of histories. You can find them, and sometimes they are useful to find some details, historical details or something like that. But it's of course not an academic critical history in what we should be interested in. You can also find individual pieces, Hans Spalling from Sweden and Leif Wittergren. They have done some research on the early work around Siegfried Edström, where they also work with archival material, as Daniel, I'm sure, will know about this. And you can also find individual other pieces on Lord Exeter, David Burley, who has been investigated, and others. But this history taken together and really showing how this organization has evolved over time, that did not exist. And that was really what interested me, and what was the main aim, to also highlight, you know, processes of transformation, of continuity, to really look at how these organizational structures and cultures, as I call them, have grown over time. So that's that was my main interest.
Okay, and I think it's also important because your work finally followed former publication on other international sports organizations. So I think it's really a step forward regarding the history of this organization, and more importantly about international sport organization. And regarding this context, perhaps, and before to go more in depth about the book, perhaps a last point, because of course to publish a book, it's also a way in itself, and sometimes it's more easy also to publish some papers on different. So
here we go. Now we cannot hear you.
Yeah, sorry, I have a problem probably with the internet. Sorry. So I have to put the record is okay. So sorry for that. What I said is about to publish a book, because for me and also as for others, as historians, probably it's something important to publish a book. Why do you have this idea to publish a book? and not the collection of paper. And how was the discussion also to publish in Routledge, also a good collection. So could you please perhaps give some point about this?
Yeah, so this process started with the paper, as it always does or often does. So this was a paper about how they established the World Athletic Championships, which was an event that came very late in 1983. And that's also when I realized that there was almost no literature out there. And I figured out, okay, I need to say much more than this. And so there was no question that if I want to contextualize, if I want to be critical, compare also to these other organizations and histories you mentioned, then this can only be done in a book format. I obviously, try to fulfill university demands when the parallel process. So some of the contents have also been published in papers, but the book is not a collection of the papers, so to say. But it's its own history. So I kind of drove this doubled strategy, but it's pretty clear. And actually, I'm very lucky to be here in Aarhus in this particular research unit where it's clearly the strategy where they say you publish books here, we publish books, and the main reason for that being, okay, the university, they want us to publish in high ranked academic journals, but those journals that they want academics to publish in, someone from sport history will not get into those anyway. So we might as well publish books. I think that's quite a sensible decision. And of course, one that favors me. Now, Routledge, that's a tough one. Of course, it's a good series. And I did also want it to be with a well-known publisher simply because it has the distribution rate and the recognition. Now it's a recorded meeting, so I can't talk too much about the downsides of publishing with Routledge. But if you have a book and turn it around, or you know how much you paid for it, then that's definitely one of the downsides. It's a good series, and I really enjoy working with the editors. Jennifer Hargraves is still editing this book series, and I had some very good conversations with her about it. So that was a plus.
Okay, thanks. I think it's also interesting to discuss about this because finally it's very rare finally that we exchange between all of us about this kind of thing. So thanks also to have taken into consideration this kind of question. So now we shift to the second part of our interview and more in depth about the book. So what I propose to you, if you are agree, Jörg, it's perhaps to take 4, 5, 6 minutes as you want to perhaps explain the main point of the book, or what do you want to put on the table about your publication. And after, I've of course some question, or I can also take perhaps some points that you elaborate, things like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's see. This can go either way. I might be done very quickly, or will takes quite a long time. So we'll see. But I think the first and most important point that I want to make is there's actually not really that much of a surprise in this book, right? We know, or we suspect already, what sports organizations look like from the inside. So we can definitely see an organization that is full of elitism, of sexism, of racism, of power games, of nationalist interests. That was something that I expected when I dived into this history. But I think it's the extent of the appearances of those dark sides of sports organizations that kind of shocked me. And also how you can see them reappearing in different forms throughout the entire history. So it did not really matter who was at the helm of the organization. But you see those tendencies, issues with race, issue with gender, clientelism, running throughout the entire history. And that is certainly also why this format of it being a book, to come back to the previous question, favored here, or made it possible to demonstrate those processes. So that's maybe the first point, without going in detail. And then I thought I'll just pick out those six presidents very quickly and just talk 1 minute about each of them, so we can go through them, because the focus of the book is on the leaders. So it is on those six presidents that this federation had, and that's six presidents in 109 years. So and one of them actually was only in charge for 4 years. So that gives the others a good average of more than 20 years of leading the sports organization, which is problematic in itself, of course. But as I said, so the first president was a Swede, Siegfried Edström, and it was really him who set up very much a hierarchical structure based on, gendered and nationality-based hierarchy, which was also the tone of the time. Which is very important to consider. Of course, we are talking about 1910s. The IAAF was first discussed in 1912 around the Stockholm Games and officially founded in 1913. And it was very important to him that these male leaders, and they were exclusively male at the time, would maintain control over all processes of the sport. And we can see that quite significantly when women started to become a threat, and how those men discussed this threat. And, you know, the rhetoric around it is like, we need to protect our sports. Those women need to get out of this activity, and they're like. and the other aspect that is important for Edström is that he was very much in favor of backroom talks. So that whilst they were having open votes, he would correspond very, very extensively with everyone, make sure all the decisions were in place before they even entered the meeting room. And that is something we also see throughout the entire history. Now, so he was in charge from 1912 until 1946. So that's 34 years. And then he became IOC president, of course. And he also picked his successor, who was a Brit called David Burley, or Lord Exeter, who kind of shared the same values, beliefs, and strategies. He was also very conservative. And he also maintained the full control over the federation. So he had no interest in changing that hierarchical system, even though sports, of course, at this point in time changes significantly, right? So we get much more economy, we get many more participants. It's the period of decolonialization. So more federations are coming in as well. But through his leadership, that there was no adaptation to those realities that occurred on the ground. And he retired in 76. So you have two presidents for the first 66 years, which is quite stunning. And then Adrian Paulan took over, who was only in charge for 4 years. And he actually sort of triggered that transformation into the commercial age, if you like. He was very close to sport marketers, and here particularly the Dassler, and also West Nelly, who we also know from FIFA or the IOC, and were very interested in the commercialization of the sport. But it was then his successor, Paulan's successor, who was the Italian I showed you on the book here, Primo Nebbiolo, who took over in 81. Who oversees this transformation. So I talked about this at Rarys too. So he moves the World Athletics from transacting less than $1 million in 1981 to transacting more than $50 million in 1999, when he dies. And with him really comes this culture of power broking, of corruption, of clientelism, really to the fore in the organization. He was sexist beyond belief. In 1998, there was the year of women's athletics. So there actually was a year to celebrate women's athletics. And he was opening this event by saying that the most important for women is to marry well, and that an Italian girl would not engage in athletics because she was too busy going out finding the right man. That was sort of the opinion that he had, and that's how I introduced the year of women's athletics, just to give you one example. So he dies in 99, and then Lamine Diack takes over. And of course, we know that he has been heavily involved with the cover-up of positive doping controls together with the Russian Athletics Federation. He also struggled in the sense that the public became more and more critical of sports organizations around the early 2000s because of Salt Lake City bribery scandal and other issues. So he also faced challenges to secure sponsors and turned very much to new money givers. So, the athletics championships were almost entirely in Europe and in East Asia until the end of the 1990s. But then they moved to Qatar, of course, to Moscow, to other places where financial support was being provided. And so it ends really the book in 2019, with the presidency of Sebastian Coe, who did initiate a governance structure reform, which I think is wide ranging and one that goes beyond what we've seen in other sports organizations also. But in many ways, he's also stuck with the organizational culture and structure in place. Many of the council members, they have been through several of these presidencies and are still in there. That's something that keeps holding the federation back. So yeah, it's those organizational structures and findings for all presidents that we can see and that are important and are running through the entire history that I think I should highlight.
Yeah. Okay.
But I can talk more.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to add some other point or because?
No. We it's better question and.
Yeah. Okay. No, I think it's also relevant because as you said, the history of your book, the history that you gave is through these six characters, and I think it's a very interesting entry to study the organization. Despite I have perhaps a little bit critics about this, but I will ask a question later about this point. Perhaps two other questions, because recently I've had the opportunity to discuss with Jean-Luc Chaplet, you know well him, and also recently Paul Dicci, about this particular places of Monaco, and it's Paul Dicci that suggests me that perhaps Monaco, I don't know if it's true or not, but Monaco was like a Qatar before Qatar, and it's true that since the 60s they engaged notably around Prince Rainier some policies in sports. They welcome some manifestations, some events, and also the IWF headquarters. So can you perhaps a little bit explain regarding the headquarters of IWF and how it arrived to Monaco?
Yeah, that's a brilliant question, because we know, of course, where the most federations are placed, and they are now in Switzerland. But there's a few that are elsewhere, and some are in Monaco. But the biggest, and I think most important for the Olympic movement, is the IAAF for sure. So the headquarters actually were placed around the locations where the president was. So it was in Stockholm for a long time, and then it moved to London with David Burley. And then Nebbiolo took over. Paulen didn't want to move from London to Amsterdam. And then he took over, and Nebbiolo, you know, he was very self-centered. He was a playboy. He didn't want to be in London. The weather was bad. The British were not friendly. He set up actually two offices, one in Torino, his hometown, and the other one in Rome, because he was also the president of the Italian Federation. He didn't want to fly up to London all the time and meet the unfriendly British. So he started this process of, we need to go somewhere else rather soon. And he had close connections to the royal family in Monaco. And then suddenly came to get a lot of money, because in 1988, the Olympic Games were staged in Seoul in South Korea. And originally the games should have been, the athletics events of the games should have been placed at a time that was unfavorable for American television. And so American television paid him and the organizing committee, I think it was $40 million to move the athletic events to a time that is better for American television, which would be early in the morning, Seoul time. And that money Nebbiolo took and created the so-called International Athletics Foundation. And that was created in Monaco. So from 86, they had this money in the bank in Monaco. Of course, tax situation was favorable for that as well. So these connections were there pretty early. And then when the federation made more and more money towards the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, they moved the federation because of tax reasons to Monaco during Nebbiolo's time. And I also mentioned the Dassler connection before. And Dassler, I mean, he was on the Ile de Marguerite, which is just outside the Monaco as well. And he died by 87, but Nebbiolo was very closely linked to that individual as well.
Yeah. Okay. It is interesting because, of course, it's as you well indicated, it's really related to the change of structure, but also the commercial way this organization, and it explains.
It's a bit of every, it's that, but I think also this personal preference of Nebbiolo played a big role as well.
Yeah, sure. and I think it's, Monaco could be also perhaps a little bit more studied for this importance, finally, of international sports development since 40 or 50 last years. A second question that I think this question was already asked during queries, but perhaps by Nicola, or I don't know, but I think it's very important because it's related to one of your ambition of your books, that is the comparative, the comparative approach. So regarding this, we know that Nebbiolo has a connection probably with Samaranch and Avalanche. And can you perhaps briefly describe the link of the president of IWF or World Athletics with other international sports organization? Do you have find in your archives some correspondence, some link between this person, or Is it new with Nebbiolo, or does it already exist, probably with H-term before?
Yeah. So yeah, that obviously plays partly into what I presented at Rares, and that is that Edström and Burley kind of saw themselves as the leader of all international Olympic sport federations. So they corresponded extensively with the presidents of Olympic sport federations, here the core sports like gymnastics or swimming, cycling, less with the football, individuals, because they were not so heavily involved, of course, in the Olympics. Now, the interesting difference between those two and Nebbiolo is that Burley and Edström were IOC members and executive board members, vice presidents of the IOC, and Nebbiolo was not. He was outside. His other involvement was that he was the president of FISU, the University Sport Federation, of course. But he desperately wanted to become an IOC member. That was one of his main personal goals. So he had this on and off relationship with Samaranch, and as I spoke about at Rary, so they together sort of outmaneuvered guys and Thomas Keller and created their own association of international sports organizations, and so on. So he was lobbying a lot and therefore had a lot of contacts with others. And of course he also became himself then the leader of this ASOIF, or whatever the pseudonym is. He was also an important personality in that regard. And of course, eventually, Samaranch awards him with the IOC membership in 1991, I think. And actually, that's also an interesting side episode, because it's a deal again that they strike with. That's after South Africa's apartheid regime falls, and Samaranch really wants to include South Africa at the Barcelona Olympic Games. But for doing that, he needs the major Olympic sport federations to recognize South Africa as national member federations. And Nebbiolo at first resists that, but then admits them, and sort of the way to say thank you, Nebbiolo receives the IOC membership.
It is interesting, because before I gave a lesson to students, and in Switzerland, for instance, during 40 years, football and athletics were connected in the same organization.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Level. So it's it depends probably of the national sports system or that exists, but it's interesting if there was not so much link with FIFA. And perhaps, and it is my last question regarding your book, presentation. Perhaps there was some concurrence, I don't know, with FIFA, but how can you categorize or put IWF or World Athletics in this umbrella of sport international sport organization? Did this organization was a big one, a small one, or so? You probably understand my question. The influence of this organization, I think, regarding my ideas. Of course, you have the International Olympic Committee, that is a little bit different, but you have also FIFA. So how can you perhaps a little bit describe this position of IWF?
Yeah, usually I get that question a lot, and I usually say it was smaller than FIFA, but bigger than everyone else. And that has, of course, to do with the popularity of the sport of football, but also if we're talking economic terms, for example, for sure, and economic terms start in the 80s, right, with all sports federations. If we think of Olympic sports, core Olympic sports, then the IWF is certainly bigger than let's say gymnastics or cycling or the like. I actually I checked that before. So even today, the IWF has three times the assets of the Gymnastics Federation, for example. So it's an economic, also powerful sports organization. And as I told you just before, they understood themselves also always as the core Olympic sports organization and as a leader of all IFs. But it did not generate the revenues that FIFA does, right? For sure not. So there's a big difference still.
Yeah, I think it's an important point because as done, for instance, with Gregory's special issue, you know, in sports industry, it's true that I think that we didn't really take into account this difference between the organization. So I like when you say it's smaller than FIFA, but larger than, say, other ones. So I think it's really a good that resume in one sentence. It's resume, you know. important. So I think it's already 40 minutes that we discuss. So I have two final question. And after I will let the floor to colleague Gregory. Just told me that he has already a question. So and I'm sure that the other colleague will have too because it's really fascinating talk. Just my two last questions. First one, and I know that you were also interested to describe this to the colleagues. It's regarding your archives, you know. So two questions regarding your archives. First, can you describe a little bit what you have found in your archive? Because in your book, it's not really detailed, you know. It's indicated where you were with collected data, but it's not indicated if, for instance, you have found new materials in Berlin or in London that you didn't found in Monaco, for instance. So that's the first question. So perhaps the connection between this archive and the second, the difficulties of the archives process and notably the access to the World Athletics archives in Monaco.
Yeah, so thanks, yeah, because I think that it's really interesting points also for the group and maybe to discuss also in a bigger forum. So concerning the question, what did I find? So that really depends on where which time period we're talking about, because that of course was one of the biggest challenges here, was covering 100 years period. And so you really cannot find everything in the same location, but you need to go to different places. So we're talking here about 15 different archives. I had a rough estimation 2 weeks ago about 80,000 document pages. So that's, yeah, something to read. But the what question is really what I was mostly interested in. And what I also base the most findings on is correspondence, right? So correspondence between those leaders in those leadership roles. And yes, for Edström in the Riksarchiv in Stockholm, there's a vast correspondence, which I believe has not been gone through entirely by scholars. So there's certainly new documents that I found for this particular archive. The same accounts for the documents that I have on Nebbiolo and his correspondence, which is actually from Cologne, from the German Sport University, where a German council member, August Kirsch, collected the entire correspondence that he had with the IWF leadership. And that kind of connects to the second question, you know, what were the problems and the difficulties? So I was incredibly lucky at the start of this project to have access to the IWF archive. And that came actually about when I was still working on my PhD on anti-doping, because I interviewed Arne Ljungqvist, who was the head of the medical commission and vice president of the federation. And I asked him whether I could not see documents at the archive for my doping project, and he arranged it for me to go there. And so I went there, and from that time onwards, I kind of just kept going there without them really telling them that I was actually not doing doping anymore, but writing their own history up. But there came a point when they had this reform, when suddenly they told me, you cannot come anymore, or if you come, you can only see documents that we allow you to see. So I had to make an application for everything. And for example, all the documents on Russia or the Soviet Union, I couldn't see at all, even though those documents were from the 70s. But that was when this whole issue of doping in Russia was ongoing. Thankfully, I'd seen some of them previously, so I could still include them. So my way then was to get around this embargo, was to actually go with individuals that were working in the Federation and try to see and find their correspondence, like August Kirsch, who had quite a lot, also in the later periods, other council members. so that was my way to get around this archival embargo. And I'd like to say that I think that was quite successful in doing that. And I think that's also important for us or other researchers when we're working on those institutional histories, that we can find a lot of those documents outside the organizations too. We don't necessarily have to go to the archives of that particular organization. It's more of identifying who could have other material and then, you know, just keep trying and exploring whether that's actually the case.
Yeah, thank you for the clarification. I think it's really helpful also for all of us that are working on other organizations. But I also noticed that perhaps contrary to other organizations, World Athletics seems to have an archivist. So I don't know if she always works there. But,
he does. I think. Yeah.
Okay. And so my last question, and after I let the floor, Yannick told me in the past a very interesting thing. He said, Philippe, you have to stop only to think in a football way. You have to decentrate yourself. You always think about football and things like that. So he has right. But I also I asked my question because what I like in your book, it's this, you know, focus on the president first. But if I take, for instance, FIFA, I think presidents are important, but you have also the board, you know, the executive committee and other members. So perhaps it's a FIFA tropism, and in EWF, the president was very important, and that is explains this focus on president. But did this focus only on president could be not too much like a personification of the organization? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's a really fair point, and one that I didn't start out like this, right? So the focus was not on the presidents from the start, but for the first three presidents, so that's Ed Sturman, Burley, and Nebbiolo, I realized that this was only about the presidents, the decision making, right? And it was their beliefs and it was their decision and how they influenced and lobbied people in letters. There was very little power that they gave to other individuals in the Federation. So I see that point that this there could be other individuals involved. I don't not see that for the first 9 years of the Federation. It changes around halfway through Nebbiolo's presidency when you really get these management processes. You know, you get legal advisors because now we're talking about high sums of money. You get marketing commissions. You get council members, vice presidents that are specifically tasked to look after specific topics. So that's at the end of the 1990s when you see that change. And certainly throughout the Axe period, we cannot centralize so much on the president anymore as in previous phases.
Okay, so no, I think it's also something that we can take perhaps into comparison between the all the organizations, the role of the president, the role of the general secretary, they are one and so thank you very much, Jörg, for this talk. So now I will close the record. Like this, we can also speak more freely. And I let the floor to the colleagues to ask a question if they want, and I'm sure they will do that. So.